Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
This won't take long.
Here's John Williams.
I got one right now. Watch this. I'm not sure it was a lie. It's 109. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio on Michigan Avenue, and that's not just me trying to antagonize you. I'm not exactly sure the president lied to us about the existence of those tapes or not anyway, so there. But it does mess up my brackets, because I've made brackets. This has just been for my own edification. It's been more for me. Kim, you could do this at home, or you could participate in mine.
I'm thinking of buying in.
But
how much is the buy-in?
Right. So say it's a dollar, and then you pick a team.
Okay.
But in this
team
case,
Comey, Team Trump.
No. It's 16 team bracket.
Oh, okay.
And the bracket is whack things Trump has said or done. So I've just been, and it was more for just like a bookkeeping thing for me, like trying to remember all of the things that I've just been so outlandish or bizarre over the last year or so. And I'm going back to the campaign. In fact, the first thing on my Trump whack brackets is him coming down the escalator. Do you remember when he announced he was going to run for president, the ride down the golden escalator?
Melania was coming down with him.
And I just thought, oh my God, when he came down the escalator, I thought, not a chance in hell. There's no way. This is bizarre. The whole scene was ridiculous. And so my brackets include more things like that than they do what he's doing to healthcare or the wall. Although you could put some of the wall stuff on there because that's just cuckoo bananas.
Well, what about the solar panels on the wall? Does that fit in?
Maybe so. That's it. For instance, when he decided to pull out of the climate accord, I know that was upsetting to a lot of people. But what makes my Trump whack brackets isn't that he did that, but that he had a four-piece jazz combo warm up the crowd before he came out. That was awesome. That was just off the charts. So my brackets include things like, well, John Miller, enough said. That was the sort of character that he created back in his days as a real estate magnate to put out words to the press. And he would actually do interviews with Vanity Fair as John Miller saying good things about Donald Trump. Whatever. I think Billy Bush does get on my whack Trump stuff. The argument about the size of the crowd. The way he shakes hands would be on my Trump whack brackets. You know, you would just put that. For instance, one of the brackets will simply read Covfefe.
That's a good one. How about pushing the president out of the way to get in the front row when he was at the...
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yes. Okay, that could be... But you only got room for 16, so you've got to be careful about that. Was it on Cinco de Mayo last year when he was sitting there with a great big bowl of Mexican salad, a taco salad, at Trump Tower? There he was at his restaurant, and he's got kind of like this thumbs-up look on his face. I love Mexicans. Mexicans love me. Happy Cinco de Mayo. And to show his affinity for those people who he had previously described as rapists, he was eating a taco salad. I always thought that was kind of whack. So I have my whack brackets, but now I may have to put in the tapes and probably have to put them in quotes because now the president says, he says there are no tapes. But before we get to that tweet, we need to get to the previous tweet, and that one went like this. James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. James Comey had better hope there are no tapes of our conversation before he starts leaking to the press. He said that May 12, 2017. That, of course, on the heels of Comey getting fired. So then Comey, by the way, if you're just keeping score at home, takes the notion that there might be tapes as a reason for him then to leak his notes to the New York Times through a surrogate at Columbia. So it was probably more damaging than the president could imagine because that really did ensure that we would have a special investigation. Okay, so whatever. He just likes to toy with people. But the investigation said, it was this, I believe this was Mueller's office saying that we need to have any tapes or transcriptions of the tapes by Friday. Well, today is pretty much Thursday. And so he has tweeted today quote, and this is two tweets, I'll read them together, with all of the recently reported electronic surveillance, intercepts, unmasking, and illegal leaking of information, I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with James Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. I did not make and do not have any such recordings. Through the Freedom of Information Act, the various media outlets, including CNN, have reached out to various intelligence gathering arms of the federal government and asked them, well, do you guys have tapes? And they said they do not. So if they don't have tapes and the president doesn't have tapes, then it sounds like there are no tapes. CNN writes this. A senior administration official said Thursday that it became clear Trump had to come clean on his lie about the Comey tapes before the Friday deadline set on him by Congress. Okay, so it was Congress that said he had to hand over any recordings. But you notice that they describe it as a lie. I don't mean to cut this too finely, but I never felt that it was a lie. I don't think the president lied to us about the existence of tapes at all.
What is it if it's not?
I think it's a figure of speech. Better hope there's no tapes, dude, because I don't agree with you.
No, a figure of speech?
I totally think that's what that was. I mean, you didn't think there were tapes. Yeah. I didn't think there were tapes. And you know that he knew, that we knew, that there were no tapes.
A figure of speech is a stitch in time saves nine. What he did, this is like if you and I were 10 and we're at a sleepover and the dad said, you better hope there's not a monster in the basement. You know, it was said clearly to have an impact, that to scare us about the fact that there might be a monster. There was an implication there. He created it out of nothing. No one ever talked about a tape until he brought up its possibility.
I don't know that I want to borrow your analogy.
Yeah,
but if I do... When Dad said that, you knew there was no monster.
Not if you're 10. I'm still not sure.
Seriously, you actually thought that was intentionally, I don't know what the word is.
It was threatening.
You thought it was a lie.
It was intimidating.
You think the president was lying to us
about
the
existence of tapes. Well, I don't know what a better word is. If you can come up with a better word, I'll give it to you. But what he did was he created a falsehood to try to intimidate or sway people's opinion. It was he alone created it, and he alone knew it wasn't true.
Boy, and he alone is suffering for it right now, too. But I got to tell you, Steve, nobody bought it. Nobody thought there were tapes. Why do you laugh at that?
And I think that's another problem. If a president says that and no one believes he's telling the truth,
then that's just a bad measure of his truthfulness. Sure, I get that. I think the greatest. You know, the worst of it, besides for the president, the fact that now a special investigator has been appointed and he shot himself on the foot on this one. But just the amount of energy, just the amount of ill will that it sows between the press and the people, or the press and the president, or the president and the truth. Really, there was no upside to this. And it was just his little nitpicky way of niggling the media, niggling Comey. You know, he has used that threat before. That's your word, threat, where he says you better hope there aren't any tapes.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
Well, that's the end of that point, but I'll just finish it. That in other depositions in his private practice as a real estate mogul, he has said to reporters or authors, not according to my tapes, or you better hope there aren't any tapes. And then under deposition, he has to admit that there were no tapes. So he's used this sort of measure before to try and gain favor or support or something like
that.
Why did he do it? Well, I don't know that I have to answer that question.
Well, no, I do. Please do.
Let me read the tweet again, and then I'll get into his mindset. Stand by. James Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press. I think he knew it was going to be his word against his word. I don't know what the hell he's trying to do.
He was trying to quiet Comey. Yeah. He was trying to keep Comey
from... Right. That's what it looks
by
like.
By saying something that was untrue.
By saying something.
By intimating something that he knew to be untrue. That's a better way to say it. Not by lying. He intimated something that he knew at the moment he said it was not true.
My number's 312-981-7200. Call or text WGN. Our president has spoken to us in his preferred means of communication, and that ain't Sean Spicer anymore, I'll tell you that. He said there are no tapes. He has no knowledge of. His exact tweet is, with all of the recently reported electronic surveillance intercepts unmasking and illegal leaking of information. I have no idea whether there are tapes or recordings of my conversations with Comey, but I did not make and do not have any such recordings. I wonder if some of the language of that was reviewed by an attorney, because that seems to be unequivocal, where the president can sometimes meander. That seems to be very specific in its second half, doesn't it? Okay, so let's pick up a couple of phone lines. Jim, you go first. You're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi.
How are you doing? When there's so many people getting fired and such, how is everything going so great at the same time? And there's a big revolving door. That's sort of whack, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, my whack brackets?
Yeah.
The revolving door of the White House? Fair enough. I'll make a note of that. Remember, there's only room for 16. Steve, if during the course of this or any conversation you go, that's just the craziest thing, let me know, because soon you'll be able to vote round by round on our Trump whack brackets, 16 Trump moments, battling it out for Trump whack supremacy. This is John. You're on WGN. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
I just think Trump was just bluffing Comey. He didn't want Comey to say anything else.
Yep.
He was just bluffing. He knew he didn't have anything.
Did this thing bother you, this whole episode, or did you think it was no big deal?
The Trump bothers me. The guy is just a big blowhard. I don't want to hear any more from him.
Thanks for the call, John. We'll go from you to Tom. You're on WGN. Hey, Tom, what do you want to say?
The perfect word is a kind of a derivation of the word obscure. Obfuscation. To bewilder.
Yeah, but, okay. So Trump didn't lie, he obfuscated?
Absolutely, and he's been obfuscating for the better part of his life. And if the media had half a grain of sense, it's like putting out a fire on the stove. You take the air out of it. They just should stop covering him. Just take the air out of his balloon, and it would be interesting to see what he does.
Thanks for the phone call. And we can't do that. We're sure not going to do that. Although I think we should be maybe a little more surgical in the stories we choose to spend time on, space on. And to be honest with you, as I'm just sitting here thinking out loud, which is probably something I shouldn't do, did the press spend a lot of time on this? Have we been writing, thinking, and talking a lot of late about the existence or not existence of the tapes? I'm going to suggest to you that we really haven't. We have been talking more of late about, say, healthcare or something else. But it sure is a distraction, isn't it? Hey, Gene, you're on the air. You're on WGN. What do you want to say, Gene?
Hi. Well, I think instrumental in Comey telling others in his bailiwick that he did not want to be alone with him. He had to know things that have been published ever since Trump was the nominee, and probably before then. The lawyers in New York City reported that they never, ever would meet with him alone. They learned the hard way.
Yeah.
That if they did, whatever took place during the meeting one afternoon or evening had changed 180 by morning. So they always went in pairs. And if Comey is privy to intelligence, he knew a lot about that man already. And plus, of course, it wasn't protocol.
Do you think the president lied about the existence of tapes?
Who knows? He probably did. He's just a bluffer and a blowhard, and he will use whatever device he can try to keep the upper hand.
Yeah, no, I think that's what Steve was saying earlier. I mean, it sure was a device. And again, I maybe it matters. Maybe I don't know how much it matters if we conclude that this is a lie, or if it was just a device, an obfuscation, a bluff.
Would you agree with untruth? No, I'm serious.
I don't know that I would.
I don't ever want to say lie. I don't want to say that.
That's freighted, but I mean, it can also be accurate. It's a very specific word with a very specific meaning. To me, lie is the same as untruth. One's more palatable. I never believed it, and I never, and I don't think he put it so specifically as to categorize it as a lie. So that's kind of where I still am on this, Steve, all of your efforts notwithstanding. Steve's on line 5. You're on WGN. Hi, Steve. Jump in here. What do you want to say?
Hey, John, I think that there was tapes. I don't trust this person to actually release tapes if there were. I think he and his people would destroy him if he knows that, you know, he would be caught doing something. I think this man has made a mockery of the presidency. I think he is a liar. I think he cannot be trusted for anything. And I am sad as an individual and as an American that we still have population who go to his rallies, who trust what he says, who applaud him, who listen to him, who want to support him. This man has done nothing to bring this country together. If anything, he has tried to divide it further. And the people in Congress and the Senate last week had an opportunity to come together. Since the shooting, this president has done nothing to try to continue that support of bringing this country together. If anything, he just continues trying to extend the divide further and try to isolate people, whether they be Democrats, Republicans, or independents. I wish that this person was no longer our president of the United States. I'd rather take Pence than I would Donald J. Trump.
Thanks for the phone call. I've been on the Twitter today. And for the first time today, I did something. I've never done this before. You want to guess what it is? Steve, go. What did I do today I've never done before? It's on Twitter.
You
retweeted Khloe Kardashian.
Khloe Kardashian.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it was...
You've never done that before?
In fact, when it came up, I went, oh, yeah, I'm following her. And I thought, oh, what is this? And she said, we need more stories like this. And so I clicked through. And there is a story about a man in Massachusetts at a mall on the top of the escalator looking at it going down. He's in his 80s and he's old and feeble. And you know that he's not sure that this is going to be a safe ride for him. Up from behind him comes a young African-American man. Looks like he's in his early 20s. He's got an incredible mop top of blonde dreadlocks. And he looks a little unpredictable, this young man with the T-shirt and the baggy shorts. And he comes up from behind the guy and gently lifts his elbow and says, I'll help you down. And takes the man safely and securely down the escalator ride and then lets him off. Woman behind them takes the picture, tells the story. It's a simple, anonymous act of kindness. And it's been retweeted now a zillion times, a zillion one now. We need more stories like that. Thank you, Khloe Kardashian, for showing us the way. Meanwhile, in another part of the city, the president has tweeted that he did not have and does not have any tapes. In its reporting about this, CNN said that his staff has to back away from the lie about the tapes. I quibbled with the word. Steve quibbled with me. We're asking you about this story generally. At 312-981-7200. You can text to that number, too. Ed wanted to jump in here. Thanks for holding, Ed. What did you want to say? You're on WGN.
Well, I want to say that this guy lies with every breath he takes. First of all, in the 100 days, he was going to build the wall or get the wall going, and that's not going to happen. And he hasn't built the wall. They haven't even got anything down there to build the wall. He was going to change health care. It was going to be that goofy-haired guy was standing there with his finger up in the air like a switch. Like a switch. I'm going to change health care. It's going to be bigger and better, and it's going to be great, and it's going to be Trumpish, and it's going to be,
by the way,
knock down the state walls.
That is an impersonation of Ro Khan impersonating Donald Trump. Let's go back to that call already in progress.
When I get to be president, I'm going to show you my taxes. And that was another lie. And that they're being audited, and you can't show them is another lie.
You've been listening to Ed, who's driving around the metro. Thank you, Ed. We get it. Let's go from Ed to Mike. You're on WGN. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I'm not at all surprised in the manner and how Trump has run his 100 days in office. If you look at Trump's profile throughout his business career, that's how he conducted himself. The man is obsessed with firing people who doesn't agree with him. He lets his ego, an enormous ego, by the way, speak instead of his mind and his mouth. And he finds out that, you know, he's going to have to put his foot in his mouth. But he's not used to people telling him what to do, how to do it. Now there's consequences to his action, and he can't really deal with it. And I think that's the biggest problem that I see is that he's always conducted himself. I mean, he even had a reality show based on firing people. This is Trump in his truest form. He doesn't like people telling him what to do. He's in a position that I think he's realizing, and that's my opinion, that he's bitten off more than he can chew. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the phone call. I'll go from you to, I think Tom is next. You're on WGN. Hey, Tom, jump in there. What do you want to say?
Yes, when someone makes a statement that's not based on facts, they know it's untrue, and it's done solely to benefit themselves and to harm someone else, that is a lie. I don't understand how you could be wishy-washy about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I appreciate your call. Let's go from you to Bonnie. I've said that I didn't think it was a lie. I don't think it was constructive. Bertrand called me out on it, and you do too, huh? Bonnie, you're on the air.
Hi, Jen. I appreciate you taking my call. You know, as I said when they answered the phone, it was May 12th when he said to James Comey, "You better not be."
Better,
you know,
hope there are no tapes of our conversations before he starts leaking to the press.
Right, exactly. It's June. It was May 12th. It's June 22nd. How long does it take for the President of the United States to find out something to be able to release that kind of information? Whether or not it's a lie, you know.
Why do you think he waited 5 weeks? And by the way, the only reason he's doing it now is because Congress gave him a Friday deadline. Why do you think he didn't do it before now? Just tell people the truth. Why do you think he waited?
Because he has so many people around him that are yes men for him, just like it's been said before. He's so used to getting his own way. He's not used to this presidency. It's not something he was prepared for.
Yeah, there's another. He bit off more than he can chew, huh? All right, Bonnie, thanks for the call. Although I got to believe that from Ivanka and Jared on down, even I'll bet even Steve Bannon, if he ever had an honest moment with the president, would say, you know, the thing about the tapes, that's actually not helping. I mean, think about what the fallout has been from the tapes. Because of that tweet, I don't know, Steve, am I right about this? Cover me if I'm not. I'm going to say something profound. Because of that tweet, we have a special investigator.
Yeah, you could draw that line.
I mean, because of that tweet, Comey releases the information, his notes, to the New York Times, and hoped that the revelation of that would lead to his express purpose was to get a special investigator by leaking notes to the Times. He did, they did, and then you got Robert Mueller sniffing around.
Yeah, but if they were going to, I mean, so few of his tweets have helped his cause. You know, if someone's going to sit down and say this isn't helping your cause,
yeah.
I mean, most of the ones, except for the very innocuous ones about, you know, Happy Flag Day or things like that, they have not helped him.
How about that Khloe Kardashian tweet? That was a pretty good one.
That was very nice.
He should have retweeted that.
I'm going to have to follow her now. Huh?
Let me see here. I'm just seeing if he's got anything else that he's put up, because this tweet uncharacteristically came in about lunchtime. You know, he's gets up real early. I don't think he's sleeping a lot, and he tweets. That's kind of his MO. But this one came an hour ago. It's 2:46 Eastern time. So he tweeted at 1:46 after lunch, perhaps. He tweeted that. It just makes it seem to me like his attorney or whoever he's listening to today said, "You've got to get in. You do it. Just put it out there that you don't have. You've had fun." That's the thing, too. Don't you get the feeling that the president has been enjoying this? In fact, again, in this one story, anyway, in the New York Times or CNN, I think I'm reading. A senior administration official said Thursday that it became clear Trump had to come clean on his lie about the Comey tapes before the Friday deadline set on him by Congress to hand over any recordings. The official, along with a Republican who talked to Trump this week, said the president has been amused at all the obsessing over all of this. In hindsight, however, the Republican close to Trump called the episode one of the worst things the president has done. So Some of you are saying, John, it sounds like you're doing the Sean Spicer cha-cha. Among the texts that have come in to 312-981-7200, John, the president was either lying or then, or he's lying now. Stop giving him the benefit of the doubt. Quit overreacting, John. President Trump's doing a fine job. How many lies would Hillary have told us by now? John, President Trump's statement that Comey'd better hope that there aren't tapes was a threat. Trump does not toy with people, John. He uses implied threats, says Sue. Here's another text. Then how did Nixon have tapes? Nixon did have a tape recording system. Kennedy had a tape recording system. Do you know, is there a tape recording system in the White House officially?
Not now, I don't believe.
Lyndon Johnson
had one, which...
Yeah, LBJ did. Wow, John, you're really off the deep end. He lied. All capital letters, and then parenthetically it says, sent with slam effect. Next text, Steve is awesome. Next text, yes, Steve Bertrand, exclamation point. Exactly, exclamation point. Next text.
I had to look up the number.
Here's one from the 815 area code. You're from that area. I agree with you, Steve. I agree with you 100%. And Trump needs to stop doing this because he's a liar and it wastes everybody's time. Two more. John, just because you and the liar know it's not true doesn't make it right. And finally, that's the new liberal perspective. We don't matter. Just their agendas. I never fall for a stage show. That is a policy now. No truth. Just pyrotechnics. I'm not exactly sure what all that last one meant, but it felt pretty good. By the way, I don't know if you recognize that song, that T for Two cha-cha, but do you remember when Sean Spicer, and that's my own musical mix, and I put it under one of his more famous press conferences where Sean Spicer was trying to explain either where the investigation is going. This, I don't think, was specifically about the existence of tapes, but it just showed how difficult Sean Spicer's job is. Steve and Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie and Scott Stantis, the Mincing Rascals that record a podcast on Thursdays, we just did one a short while ago, and I have all talked about whether or not Sean Spicer's work is honorable or not, and for that matter, members of the Trump cabinet. That is, if you think that this guy's a bad guy, he's not good for America, then should you serve in his cabinet or not? Say you're a Republican and you have conservative values and you want to make America great. Should you or should you not serve this president? And I've said that you probably should, but they all... I don't mean to misrepresent you all, but I think we're saying, no, there's no honor in this work at all. Anyway, it was during one of Sean Spicer's press conferences when he at least revealed how difficult, how utterly difficult his job can be.
I think there's a difference between directing the Department of Justice, which may be involved in an ongoing investigation, and asking Congress as a separate body to look into something that...
You know, hold on. He's going to come around. He's reloading that thought. What is that?
To look into something and add credibility to the look adds an element that wouldn't necessarily be there if we were directing the Department of Justice, for example. But again, I think we've made it very clear how he wants this done and where we go from there.
It was a very strange day for him. What's happened to him, by the way? Where's Spicer, Steve? Do you know? Did he do the daily White House press briefing today?
He did not.
Yeah. Did anybody? Was there one today?
Yeah, Sarah
Huckabee did.
It's not doesn't end in Huckabee, right?
Huckabee's her middle name, and it's Sarah Huckabee
Sanders. Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
There you go.
She did. There was reporting earlier this week that Spicer maybe was looking to move up or out. You know, have more of an overarching communication strategy, and someone else would do the daily briefing.
Right, yeah.
And they would lose a year of their life every day. But I don't know. He didn't do it today.
Honey, I got good news and bad news. The good news is I've got a promotion. Oh, really? What are you going to be doing now? I'm going to be the White House press spokesperson. That's the bad news. Any promotion but that is a no-win proposition. Hey, John, you're on the air. What did you want to say? Hi.
Well, maybe I'm missing something, but didn't he say he doesn't know of any, which doesn't mean there aren't any? Did I miss that?
Yeah, I think he was. I don't think this was vague. He said. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, he said, with all the surveillances going on, who knows if there are any, but I know that I didn't put any in there. They're not mine.
But I did not make and do not have any such recordings. So if there is, he's off the hook. You got that, John?
Yeah.
Sorry. It's 156.
The Weird, Wild, Wonderful.
WGN Plus. It's a whole other world.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I broke a little earlier. I got a couple more minutes, so I'll sneak in one more phone call. But I also told you that I was going to just give you the details now. If you have not yet, please go to WGNradio.com/events. I'll come on to stage and talk for about 60 seconds or so on August 12th. This will be at the College of DuPage at the Mackinich Performing Arts Center. I'll come on to stage, talk for a few minutes, and then I will invite out onto stage in person, live, you will believe it, the 26th President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. TR and I will talk a little bit about his days and these days. I like to ask him about what it was like being president then, about how he walked softly and carried a big stick, about charging up San Juan Hill. We've done these conversations many times, and easily half the time, or every time, more than half of the information is new. There's endless Teddy Roosevelt stories, and RTR knows them all, and he tells them eloquently and comically and manically, because they're all of those things. And then you get a chance to ask him questions, too. Half the audience is always dragged to these shows. I mean, you want to give up a Saturday morning in August to go see Teddy Roosevelt talk at the College of DuPage? I understand this is a leap. But I'm telling you, whenever somebody leaves this show, they cannot believe how fast the time went, how much fun they had, how glad they were there, and how they're going to bring their friends next time. So, this time, go to WGNradio.com/events. Go to WGNradio.com/events. Ticket information is there. Or call for tickets right now, 630-942-4000. 630-942-4000. There is the business, and we had arranged this sort of conversation for some time now. It just happens to fall into today's show. There's no real immediate relevance other than we've been meaning to have this conversation, so we're going to have it today. And that is the emoluments clause. If the president, for instance, this weekend goes to Mar-a-Lago and a lot of federal money is spent there, does that violate the domestic emoluments clause? And if he hosts the ambassador from Japan, or if he somehow profits because foreign dignitaries are spending money in his properties, then does that violate the international emoluments clause? And is he profiting too much? Should he be profiting at all? There's a pro and a con on that. This is, to be honest with you, one of those instances where I think it's easy for us to get distracted. I don't find this all terribly important, but I would like to hear the pro and con on it. Is it wrong, or is it okay?
So he's holding campaign fundraisers for himself at his hotels.
Yeah.
Which is just genius.
Right, it is.
Right?
I know, because then the campaign money is spent on him.
Right.
He's spending his campaign money on his company.
So he's raising money from other people for his campaign, and then he's spending it on his property.
And that may be the most legal thing of the things he's doing relative to this conversation.
Right.
Because what really concerns people is that whenever a foreign delegation is going to come here, you know where they think it's smart to stay.
It makes you want to build a hotel and run for office.
It's like a friend of mine said, you want to get $1 million? Here's what you do. First, get $1 million. And once you get that million going, boy, then it's a lot easier.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
I already did.
Here's John Williams.
Kind of exhausted after that last hour. This is John. Boy, it's hot downtown, but it's a summer day in Chicago. A little breezy.
Lord have mercy.
Some white clouds, some dark clouds, some blue skies. It's a summer day. Let's go swimming. Let's go for a bike ride. Oh, wait, we got to finish the show. We're in the Allstate Showcase studio until 3. Then Ro Khan and Anna DeVlantis will entertain and inform. By that, I mean Ro will go off on some crazy tangent. He'll just get all his undies in a knot, and it will calm him down and bring peace to the Midwest. So as I understand it, the eighth clause in Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution says, no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present or emolument, office or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. And for that clause, the president is now being sued by three different groups. Attorneys General from Washington, D.C. and the state of Maryland. 200 Democrats are suing him, and there's a group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Governments with important business with the United States are always sending people over here, and guess where they are wise to stay? In Trump properties. So he's benefiting or profiting from that. So is that a violation? Is that what we wanted to keep from happening? Maybe somebody trying to gain undue influence or curry favor with the president because they're spending money on his properties? Foreign diplomats have been flocking to D.C. for, well, since before the election, that's for sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And so we have two guests online. The first is John McKyle. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University. And Trevor Burrus also joins us, research fellow at the Cato Institute. John, let's start with you. Thanks for joining us on WGN Radio. What's your take about this story generally? Is that a fair description, first of all, of the lay of the land here?
Yes. Well, first, thank you very much for having me. I think you described the situation quite accurately.
And is... But here's what I don't exactly understand. If, say, Donald Trump has a property, a hotel, a golf resort, he can't keep these people from foreign countries from coming to the United States. They can stay wherever they want. So if they choose to stay at his place, he'll be the beneficiary of that. But even if he didn't want them to, they may yet do it. So how is this his fault or responsibility?
That's a fair point. I think the way to look at that is that the problem here constitutionally is not between Donald Trump and potential customers that he might have, but rather the relationship between him and the rest of the government, the Constitution, and the citizenry in general. So it's the Constitution that sets up the framework of rules, and President Trump has to comply with that framework.
So how's he supposed to do that? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, The problem that's really teed up by the emoluments clause, the foreign emoluments clause to which you referred, pertains to foreign government officials. So no one is claiming that the Trump organization can't continue to do business with the vast majority of marketplace participants, private companies, private persons, and so forth. It's a small subset, really, of potential commercial partners that pose the big problem here. The way out, there are a couple solutions. The main one is to follow the text of the Constitution, which vests in Congress the authority to grant consent when foreign emoluments are being received by government officials. And that's something that the president has not done. That is to say, he has not cooperated with the Congress. And given them the opportunity to exercise their constitutional authorities in this regard. So that's one way this could go. The second, of course, is the option of divesting genuinely separating out his ownership interests in a way that would comply with the sorts of ethics norms that people like the Crew Organization have been pressuring him to do.
Trevor Burrus is on the line from the Cato Institute. Trevor, welcome to the conversation. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to that?
Well, I want to preface this by saying I am concerned about Trump's business holdings and a lot of the possibilities for malfeasance here, but I do not think that this simply having foreign officials stay in the Trump hotel. And also we have a similar claim in one of the lawsuits that actually airings of The Apprentice and some of its spinoffs on foreign-owned media, they're also including that as an emolument. They just definitionally are not emoluments. Emoluments is a weird word that we don't use anymore, but what it actually means for the framers of the clause is that it was merely lawfully authorized compensation for an office. And so the emoluments that are for the president are created by Congress. Extra gifts, gifts in the course of having a business, those are not definitionally emoluments. And that's only just part of the problem, because also the emoluments clause does not apply to the president himself, because he is not someone who holds an office of the United States. In addition to that, they have a standing problem because no one's really hurt by this. So these lawsuits have three strikes against them, and I predict that they'll go nowhere.
What do you say about that, John?
Well, I have to take issue with several of those points. So let's begin with the fundamental question, what is an emolument? Both Donald Trump's lawyers at a private law firm before he became president and now the Department of Justice in their filing to the federal court in New York have made this argument, which is to say that as a matter of definition, the profits and benefits that are being complained of here are simply not emoluments in the sense that the founders understood that term. So it's an originalist claim. And I think that the claim is simply false. It's easily disproven. I've actually been taking a very close look at this question with the help of a terrific research assistant. And we have looked at a massive number of English language dictionaries from the 17th, 18th centuries, pretty much all of the available dictionaries. And let me tell you the main finding. In the overwhelming majority, in fact, I would say pretty much every last one of them, an emolument is defined primarily as a, quote, profit, gain, advantage, or benefit. There's no stipulation in any of those dictionaries that the term means compensation for a government office or a public salary of some sort in the way that that the Department of Justice and President Trump has been arguing. So that's really the first big problem with his argument. I do think the courts are going to have to address this question on the merits, and I just have to take issue with the idea that somehow the evidence from the founding generation, the founding era, is going to help President Trump. On the contrary, I think it's going to be very difficult for him.
Well, you know, his business dealings are so complicated. I don't know how the guy would be able to extricate himself from somebody staying at one of his properties. How do you track it, et cetera, et cetera? Why don't they just ask the Congress, can we do this? And would the Congress rubber stamp it? How would I wonder what I have a guess, but you know, there's more Republicans in the Congress than there are Democrats. It would seem to me like there's a way out on this. Just ask the Congress for permission. Is it not that simple, Trevor?
Well, because of what you just said, that the complexity of this and also what sort of gains we're talking about. So if Donald Trump gets residuals or has some sort of copyright holding on The Apprentice, extricating himself from that, it's very, very complex. But I want to just address it. You know, John's point about dictionary is interesting, but there's contemporaries founding evidence that shows that, yes, it was exactly what they meant by emoluments was merely compensation for an office. And probably the best evidence of this is the would-be 13th Amendment. There was an amendment proposed to the Constitution in 1810 that would have actually made it illegal for citizens, private citizens, to get emoluments from foreign governments. And if they did, then they would be stripped of their citizenship. And under John's argument, this would mean that a person who ran a tobacco shop in Philadelphia who sold some tobacco to a diplomat from France could be stripped of his citizenship, and that almost became part of the U.S. Constitution. And under no possible circumstances is that what people thought emolument meant when all but two states to ratify that amendment to the Constitution.
I guess that's your turn, John. What do you say to that?
Yeah, it's a fair point, and I think Trevor is right to focus on that historical event. It is somewhat puzzling, and I grant that. I guess I would make a couple of points. First of all, if my recollection serves me, that proposed amendment did also include a clause which vested in Congress the authority to grant permission. So in other words, it could be seen as an amendment which set a very harsh, bright-line baseline, but then, of course, did afford our legislature the opportunity to pass laws to handle all of these situations, with, you know, which do seem somewhat counterintuitive. There's a second point, and I don't know if anyone in the litigations have made this point, but as a scholar, I think it's not implausible. There is no question that the term emolument has shifted its meaning, its primary meaning, over time. Because today, if you look in a dictionary, either a legal dictionary or an English language dictionary, you will, in fact, find the definition that that the Department of Justice is proffering here. It's something more like an office or employment-related compensation. So that means we know, if what I said earlier is correct, that a change has occurred. And it may, in fact, be that at the time of the 1810 Amendment, that change was already happening. And let me make this point a little bit more concrete. Noah Webster, who authored the first great American dictionary, he's most well known for his 1828 dictionary. That's sort of the classic Webster dictionary. In 1806, he actually published his first dictionary. And in that dictionary, he defined emolument in the way I've described, which is to say profit, gain, advantage, benefit. But in the 1828 dictionary, he now introduced two definitions, and one of them was the office compensation-related definition. And so what that suggests is that there may have been a shift of meaning. And so I'm not ready to concede that the 1810 amendment should, in fact, be interpreted in the same way as the 1787 Constitution. It's a natural assumption for us to make, but any historian will tell you that that's, you know, to leap a couple of decades and assume that things are exactly the same, that's a questionable move.
Well, you know, to both of you, I would say this, though. I'm not persuaded that even Donald Trump would compromise the integrity of a decision or the United States because he's sold a bunch of rooms at one of his estates. I mean, that's just, to me, kind of a silly concern when you consider all of the stakes that are at play. And frankly, what's, I think, more bothersome to a lot of us is how much money is being spent on Trump properties by the United States government. I mean, when he's hosting dignitaries or golfing or going to all of his different resorts or Mar-a-Lago or whatever, I think people are kind of put off by that. We're all putting a lot of money into his coffers. Forget Japan. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I want to reiterate that there's a lot of concerning things here, but they don't all have to be emoluments. You know, we do have in the impeachment clause of Article 2, it says one of the reasons the president can be impeached is for bribery. So we have other possibilities to get at the president without calling everything and anything an emolument. And I just want to say one point to John's point. Before the 1810 Amendment, we had President Washington, who ran Mount Vernon as a plantation while he was president, a man whose attitude toward the presidency informs us today, and it sold internationally tobacco and other goods, and it possibly, we don't have the full records, could have sold them to foreign governments and foreign officials. And again, I think that no one actually considered whatsoever that the fact that Mount Vernon would sell to foreign governments could possibly be an emolument.
Is that where this conversation is going to be decided, guys? 19th century dictionaries and the intent of the founding fathers? I mean, is that really how this game gets played?
I think it gets played by them not having standing first.
What do you mean by that, Trevor?
Which is that there's a sort of a detail that's important in a bringing a court case to say that you have to demonstrate that you were actually hurt by the actions that you're accusing. And it seems that no one here can say that people staying in Trump's hotels are hurting me in some way.
Yeah, what about that, John? I mean, really, well, that goes back to my point a moment ago. I may not like it, but what's the harm in all of this?
Well, I think there is a harm in all of this. I think we should distinguish the question of whether there's a harm to individuals and to the public generally from what Donald Trump is actually arguing in court. He's essentially saying, look, no one has the right to sue me. So Trevor's right. The question of standing is the threshold question here in all three of these lawsuits, and it is a significant hurdle. We're going to see how the courts decide to adjudicate that matter. But it's quite striking that the fundamental argument that President Trump, through the Justice Department, is making is no one has the right to sue me, not a watchdog group like Crew, not private owners of hotels and restaurants, not individual states, and not members of Congress either. And at some point, you have to ask yourself, why is that the primary defense? Why isn't the president saying, I deny that there's a conflict of interest, here, and I'll prove it to the public by being transparent and open with, you know, those aspects of my businesses which people are questioning.
This
is really a quite perverse a form of argument, at least so it seems to me.
Yeah.
Well, of course, any lawyer who didn't raise that argument would be committing malpractice. That's why.
Oh, well, that's true. I don't, it's not surprising in a way that the lawyers are making that argument, but he's the president. He's also speaking to the appearance of conflict of interest and corruption, and everybody understands that that's the way that these things go. You don't just deny the real thing, but you try to address any appearance. But what's so striking is that in this case, there doesn't seem to be that good faith effort to address that fundamental concern.
That's John McKyle. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University. He and others are filing an amicus brief on this case and following it just as closely as Trevor Burrus, research fellow at the Cato Institute. Guys, I'm out of time, but I mean, what's the next sort of event about this? When are we going to hear what the decision is? Or decisions, I guess, huh?
It'll be a few months on the standing issue, I would say, before we get to the question of what an emolument is.
But he may not be president by the time we decide what the final ruling on these cases is.
True.
All right. On that, I'll leave you, Trevor. Thank you for your time. John, the same to you. Thanks for your time and expertise, fellas. I'll call you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And there you go. It's 224. This is WGN. We already bought and sold our houses. We moved out of Minneapolis and put everything in a truck. And everything we own is being held in that truck in storage until it's moved into our place next week. I got to tell you, Steve, I lie awake at nights. You know how you do that sometimes? Worrying yourself more than you should, but you're just sitting there in bed, listening to your heartbeat, worrying too much about something. And the thing that I've been worrying about is all of that stuff going to fit in our new, really small place? Because we more than halved our living space. You know, we went from over 2,500 square feet to about 1,300 square feet. So we got rid of a lot of it, and we gave some of it away and blah, blah, blah. But now this truck's going to pull up, and I'm like, oh, that's not all going to fit. But we knew that, so we got a storage locker. And they said, well, how much space do you need? And I said, I have no idea. What's the biggest one you've got? They said 10 by 20 by 9, 9 feet high, 10 feet by 20 feet. You look in that, some of us were raised in places smaller than that, and I'm still not sure that's enough. So I just lie there in bed at night and worry that we're going to have enough room for all of our stuff. Do you need some more stuff by any chance? Because I've got a lot of stuff if you need more stuff. By the way, this texter said, LOL, John, about your last couple of guests. That is the same constitutional clause that prohibits you from becoming king, right? The emoluments clause? It's almost 2:30. Steve's going to do the news next on WGN. We reached out to Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's been on our show before, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of that book, An American Sickness, which talks about this very subject. It's a great book on our healthcare crisis these days. Elizabeth, welcome back to WGN. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me. Or busy here, sitting here between the White House and Capitol Hill.
What are you reading today? How is the bill changing? And kind of give me some of the highlights.
Well, the highlights are that it in some cases goes further than the House bill and in some cases rolls it back. But I think the things that concern people about the House bill are still very concerning in the Senate bill. It drastically reduces federal payments for Medicaid. We like to think of that as, oh, that's the insurance for the poor, low-income folks. But in fact, it covers much of the nursing home care in the United States for people just like me, people who go into nursing homes with insurance or with Medicare. And then because people are living a lot longer and because health care is so very expensive in our country, they run out of those benefits and end up on Medicaid. So for anyone who would think, this stuff about, you know, rolling back Medicaid payments is just about other people, it's really about all of us.
What would happen to Medicaid payments under this?
Well, what happens is, and both the House and the Senate bill do this in various ways and with various timescales, is there's a cap on what the federal government will pay for Medicaid. Right now, they match states. Under the Affordable Care Act, they actually expanded payments for Medicaid, allowing people in with who are above the federal poverty level. That's all scheduled to go away. And really, the difference between the House bill and the Senate bill is how fast it goes away, how quickly it goes away. And, you know, what they're trying to do is kind of thread the needle to keep a lot of different conservatives and moderates happy. And there's some indication that so far they've kept no one happy.
If you drive people to poverty, though, I mean, if they have to spend all of their money, all of their assets, liquidate everything to keep them in a nursing home or get them the extraordinary health care they need, then they at some point will be so poor that the government will pick up the tab with via Medicaid. Is that right?
Well, I think that's the question, is the states are capped in what they will get for Medicaid. And think of what Medicaid includes now. It's nursing home care, it's opioid addiction and treatment. That's really, really expensive stuff we're talking about. And if the federal government says, you know, sorry, guys, but we're going to ratchet down what we're going to help you, how we're going to help you out in this with money. The states don't have money. They can't print new bills, right? So they're going to have to figure out what can and can't we offer through this Medicaid program. And we don't have a good answer for that. Like, what do you say to a person who's in a nursing home on Medicaid and when the state runs out of money? Like, oh, sorry? You know, what's supposed to happen?
Right.
I don't think there's a good plan B. And the problem is, as with everything in healthcare, these policies that kind of sound good in theory, they play out on people's lives and on their wallets and on their health. And until we go, wow, this really didn't work the way we intended it to. Well, I think, you know, and as you see in the Senate bill and in the House bill, they're often written with a very long tail. So when it plays out badly, it's after the election and on someone else's watch. You know, maybe it's on the governor's watch in the state. But in this case, a lot of these governors who expanded Medicaid and who are going to be left trying to figure out, well, how are we going to pay for this? They're in red states. They have Republican governors. So I think that's why you see a divide between the GOP governors and what we see going on in the Senate.
Well, people in red states don't need Medicaid? I mean, gee whiz. Why are they doing this? Is it simply because they feel like we can't afford it, I guess?
Well, it is true that we cannot generally, in the big picture, afford to spend what we spend in this country on health care. It's, you know, close to 20% of the economy. That's why I wrote my book, which is to say that we pay too much for everything. We have to get control of the prices we pay for health care in the U.S., which are 2 to 3 times or more than in other countries of the world, even in countries where they have kind of a more market-based system. And until we do that, I think what we're seeing in Congress now, but also to some extent what we saw with the ACA, nothing is going to work very well because, you know, as someone said in an editorial once in Health Affairs, it's the prices, stupid. Like, we can't pay this much
right.
for MRIs and blood tests and hospitalizations and expect any plan to kind of come out okay for patients or for the governors who have to come up with this money.
Medicaid's going to be challenged then if this version of the bill passes. What are some other headlines for you, Elizabeth?
Well, I think a big headline is that they would allow insurers in states that took this waiver to charge patients who had pre-existing conditions more. And, you know, again, if people like to think, well, that's somebody else. No, everyone in my family is okay. I think we should remember that before the Affordable Care Act made that illegal. Under the Affordable Care Act, people with pre-existing conditions had to be given insurance. They couldn't be rejected. And they also had to pay the same rates as other people. Before the Affordable Care Act, what could be a pre-existing condition? Having mild asthma, using an inhaler once a year when you run, you know, having had a history of an abnormal pap smear. You know, minor things, so that kind of being human could put you in that you have a pre-existing condition category.
Wasn't having been pregnant a pre-existing condition, too? Maybe not, yeah. But I mean, we heard of all of these sort of, you know, severe interpretations of that, and it struck me as almost a scare tactic. Is that really going to preclude people from being able to get affordable health care if they had an abnormal pap smear or had an inhaler once upon a time?
Well, unless we find a better way to police or monitor or regulate what insurers are doing, yes, it did before and it will again. I mean, they won't be able to say we're going to reject you from insurance, but they will be able to say, according to this, in states that take a waiver, we're going to charge you more, however much we want. And yeah, that effectively is saying you can't get insurance.
Talk to me about the politics of this briefly, Elizabeth Rosenthal, who is with Kaiser Health and is also the author of the book. She's been on our show before. Have you read this yet? An American Sickness. I'm hearing maybe four, maybe more senators aren't loving this already, Republicans that they need. Yep. What do you handicap it a little bit?
Well, I don't know. You know, there's always this being a relative newcomer to Washington. I've been down here for about a year. You see that there's a lot of political theater when a new bill comes out. But I think what to me is really significant is two of those four Republican senators that said they couldn't support the bill were on that secret committee of 13 senators who wrote the bill. So what does that tell you? You know, that even the people who were in the room are coming out now saying, I don't like what we, you know, how it came out. So I would say that doesn't bode well. On the other hand, you know, so many of these people now have run on the Republican side on this, we're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something better and cheaper. And now they feel like they have to do something. And, you know, to be fair, there were problems with Obamacare. You know, it didn't live up to its promise entirely. Some people were hit with really high deductibles and premiums, which is what the GOP is always talking about. That's true. I would say there were plenty of other people who got care who never had it before.
Right.
And we had to solve that problem. And again, to me, it all comes back to why are those premiums high? Why are the deductibles and copays high? Not just for ACA plans, but for you and me, for everyone. And it's because we've never faced up to this pricing problem we have.
Does this bill fix the super high premium and deductible problem that people have been experiencing?
Well, I mean, one way where it nominally, theoretically could is if you let people sell insurance that's junk insurance, right, that doesn't cover most of the things that they might need. You can offer a really, really low premium, right? But then what you find, it's just like those teaser mortgages, right? When you actually go to use it or a couple of years down the road when you actually get sick, you find out, oh, well, you know, it doesn't include that, or guess what? It has a deductible that's $20,000. So, you know, you can make the premiums look much more affordable without actually offering people genuine insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the worry, that's the easy way to do it, is you just, as the Republicans have done, taken away some of the requirements for what health insurance, what standard good health insurance should look like. And then you can offer really low premiums, but when people go to use it, they may be really stuck with some huge bills and unaffordable surprises.
Lastly, can you just speak briefly about how this bill addresses Planned Parenthood?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting part of the bill, and perhaps the one that is will be most up in the air over the next few days. We're really looking carefully at this. It includes a one-year ban on Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood. That was a key demand of the anti-abortion groups. If you look on a little a gallery of who wrote this bill that we made at Kaiser Health News this morning, you'll see that every one of those senators has 100% rating from the pro-life groups. So you can tell where they're coming from. The problem on this effort will be, in practice, the Senate is passing this bill or wants to pass this bill through something called budget reconciliation. That means that anything that's in this bill has to have an impact, a primary impact on the federal budget. That the reason that the provision is in the bill is because it affects the budget. So the next step for this bill is it has to go through the Senate parliamentarian, who will decide if that provision about defunding Planned Parenthood can even go to the House floor, because it really, as I think we all know, isn't primarily about a budget issue. It's about defunding abortion services, which many of the Republicans don't want to be offered.
Hmm. All right. Well, we'll see how this goes, and I'm going to start calling you more and continue to tell people to get your book, find out a little bit more about this, and then, you know, be a little more proactive, both as a consumer and as also a citizen, because I think it's, you know, if it's going to change again, let's be smart about it, right?
Right. Now we have to have our voices heard if it's going to change again.
Elizabeth, let's visit again. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and the author of An American Sickness. It's 2:52. This is WGN. Hey, congratulations. Yesterday was National Selfie Day. Told you to send us a selfie pic of you. Thank you for doing that. Ron wins our best selfie. He was smart enough to put a picture of me in his selfie with him. So he's got some tickets to the 2017 race season at Sycamore Speedway. And we got a Lou Malnati's gift certificate for him, too. Thank you, Ron. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram. It's 2:55. By the way, Kevin, I was looking at the bankruptcy story of Boris Becker. And then I'm seeing all of these other names of athletes who've declared famously bankruptcy. Mike Tyson on down. Scottie Pippen's not on that list, right? Am I correct about that?
Yes, I don't see anything that says he's actually officially declared for bankruptcy. I have seen articles, though, that said he blew away most of his $120 million career earnings.
He always seems to be in a good mood when he's sitting there at a game.
Well, yeah, because he's in an advisory role to the Bulls, and you know how they bring back alumni and things like that.
Which
so I'm sure
think is smart.
Yeah, I think he's finding ways to make a few bucks here and there. But, yeah, $120 million, John, down the drain, Johnny Depp style.
Vince Young, $26 million guaranteed, went bankrupt. Lenny Dykstra. I didn't know Bill Buckner went bankrupt. Did you see that?
I did not know that. Allen Iverson, NBA.
Well, how much
MVP.
Money did Iverson make? He made hundreds of millions.
Well, according to this one article, made over $200 million in his storied career, but mostly broke now. He lost a large chunk of that.
Michael Vick, Terrell Owens.
I need a rich friend because, you know, I'm sure a lot of these guys just hand out cash to their posse, their buddies.
Yeah,
I need to find a really rich friend and just leech off them.
And then some of them that often says bad investments. And I'm thinking, the reason you make investments is to get a bunch of money. If you have a bunch of money, don't make investments. Just keep the money. Just go spend the money. Buy a house, get a nice car, get two nice houses.
Like Curt Schilling, the pitcher. He invested into video game company.
It was a video game. He was going to be the next big thing.
Right. Because that seems like a great thing to put. Like, why? You're secure with your $80 million of career earnings. Why take a shot on a video game company?
Yeah, because what's that going to do? Make you $80 million? You've already got $80 million. Dollars. Yeah,
yeah. I dream of someday blowing $100 million, John.
Yeah, I know. I want to. Listen, if I do get $100 million, it will not go to waste. It will not get blown. It will not get lost. It'll be in a conservative account earning 1% and will be fine. If you have $100 million and you're making 1%, you could live on that.
There you go.
I'll stop talking now. Ro will be joining us shortly. He's assembling a kit.
It's actually a little microphone kit. Oh, no, it's a
headphone kit. He's actually assembling some headphones.
When I'm done with my ultralight, I'm going to get right on this whole
He's such an engineer. It's great.
There you go.
Gifted.
Yeah, yes, I am. Thank you very much. Thank
Hi, Rokan. Hi, Anna DeVantis.
Hi, John.
Hello, John Williams.
So the plan for today?
Michael Steele is going to explain to us what the hell just happened in Washington. That's like every day. President says there are no recordings. Don't worry about it. I don't know what you people were talking about. Although I just heard a very interesting analysis of why there might be the thought that there would be recordings.
Really?
He may not have been saying, I had recordings. It might have been, I hope you didn't make recordings.
Right. Maybe Comey was actually recording the conversation.
Right. You better not be recordings, okay? So kind of that side of it. So
but
we'll
you laid to rest the idea that he has them today.
Well, right, and it was 41 days later. It was an incredible act of bravery on his part because the House and Senate both said they needed him by tomorrow.
Right,
so he had to lay that to rest.
To let him know anyway.
Not really a surprise to anybody, but the health care bill hits, and four Republicans say they are not going to vote for it. Super conservative Republicans, including our own Ted Cruz. Our own Ted Cruz, yes.
You mean the queso eating Ted Cruz?
No, I was just talking
guy?
To his character on the show. So.
I was just talking to somebody who said that of the Elizabeth Rosenthal from the Kaiser Health Institute, she said of the 13 senators who crafted this, two of them have come out and said, I'm not supporting that. Two of the guys.
In the room.
That
in
wrote
the room.
It. The secret group that wrote it. Okay, that's not very good.
We don't like that.
Ted's one of them, by the way.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So he's. So Michael Steele will explain what all of that means to us. Also, what is the Uberification of America? And is it good for us or bad for us? A really interesting analysis of what these young tech companies, young-led and nascent technology companies have changed the world, gig economy and all the rest of it. What happens when they really head into Wall Street? And you saw it with Travis Kalanick this week, who had to leave Uber. Mm-hmm. And so what does it all kind of mean for the rest of the economy? It's really a fascinating analysis, and our own Susan Schmidt will share that with us as well.
No, I'll be listening. That was a good show.